It's time for Let's Talk with Brian Pettaway.
Good morning, happy Sunday, and welcome to Let's Talk. It is that time. I am your host, Brian Pettaway. I'll be here with you for about an hour today, from now until about 11 o'clock. And I've got a lot of things going on the show today, but we are smack dab in the middle of Women's History Month. And along with that theme, I'm going to rerun a segment that I did with a Dr. Yolanda Lawson. Now, what makes her special is not only what she's done and what she does for women's health, but she's also only the 10th woman ever elected as the president of the National Medical Association. So she's going to be talking today about a myriad of things. I'm going to dive into how she got to be where she is and some things about women's health that, you know, that men in particular would like to know. Also, I'm going to give a brief history on women's education, how they got from where they were to where they are, and it's an amazing, incredible journey, so I'm going to give a brief history on that. I've also got the petty here today, some Sunday fun facts, but of course you're going to start with me first, and what I love to do is give brief news and commentary of the past week's events. So I hope you're feeling great, because I'm feeling great. I've got lots to talk about this Sunday morning, so let's get right to it. Well, last week, time sprung forward an hour. The weather's starting to get warmer, the days are starting to get longer, and that all represents spring and summer activities beginning in the city of Baltimore. And yes, I am referring to the Baltimore Orioles in Camden Yards, and I'm excited about that. But one of the other things that's inevitable to happen as the weather gets warmer is the return of the Squeegee Kids. And already, unfortunately, Fox 45 is reporting an incident downtown where three Squeegee Kids were arrested after officers saw them taking a driver's phone and sending money to themselves via Cash App. Just the other day, the 14th, around 6 p.m., officers were monitoring the City Watch camera located at Dundalk and Hollabird Avenue when they saw an interaction between Squeegee Kids and the driver of a Nissan Sentra. Officials say during the observation, one of the suspects, later identified as 21-year-old Deidre Colvin, was seen reaching into the vehicle and taking the driver's cell phone. While this was happening, the other two suspects, later identified as 23-year-old Savion Colvin and a 19-year-old male, were seen cleaning the windshield of the vehicle, seemingly as a distraction to extend the interaction. Police say officers responded to the scene and spoke with the driver, who reported noticing several Cash App transactions totaling $550, which were taken by the suspects. According to police, all three suspects were promptly apprehended and transported to the central booking intake facility for larceny charges. Another driver contacted officers, claiming that the same suspects had taken over $2,000 from their Cash App account. So listen, this is what I'm going to tell you. If you do not have a dollar or $5 cash available when these guys are squeegeeing your windshield, or before they do, don't let them do it, and do not roll down your window with your phone in your hand. Just don't do it. It's unnecessary. Yes, I want to sponsor kids and I want to help them have a great summer by putting some money in their pocket. But as you can tell by the ages of these suspects, they are not kids. They're grown men. They are adults, right? Kids are 12, 13, 14, 15 years old. So if you don't have cash when they approach you, say no, keep your windows rolled up, and keep it moving. It's really that simple. You gotta be safe. You can be kind, but you gotta be safe. Well, in Fulton County, Georgia last week, Judge Scott McAfee kept his word and did rule on the Fannie Willis case, and he ruled that she can still be the prosecutor against Donald Trump in his attempt to interfere with the 2020 election. There was a stipulation by Judge McAfee, however, and one of those, and the biggest, is that Nathan Wade, the special prosecutor for Fulton County, has withdrawn from the Georgia election interference case. He's out following an order by McAfee stating that either he must go or District Attorney Fannie Willis will be disqualified from prosecuting Trump. Wade offered his resignation in a letter to Willis, saying he was doing so in the interest of democracy. Now, there are a lot of people saying that this is a win for Fannie Willis because she continues to be the prosecutor in this case, but to be very honest with you, anything that Fannie Willis had hoped to gain by trying this case before the election is gone, because it will not be heard till long after the election, when the relevance of this case means absolutely nothing. There is none. She, in a case of poor judgment, has completely undermined and derailed her entire case and all of her brilliant work. And it's a shame, because she was a rising star in the DA's office in Fulton County. Now the DA's office is a laughingstock, and she's a crash and burn victim at her own hands. Well, also in the news is Mike Pence. As Mitch McConnell falls in line for Donald Trump, and Tim Scott falls in line for Donald Trump, and many others, Mike Pence is not. Mike Pence says that he cannot in good conscience endorse Donald Trump, and will not. He says, and I quote, that Donald Trump is pursuing and articulating an agenda that is at odds with the conservative agenda that we governed on during our 4 years. That's why I cannot in good conscience endorse Donald Trump in this campaign. Well, good for Pence. That's what he says today. Let's see if he stays that way. Let's see if he keeps that opinion through the election process. All right, it is now time for fun facts. So we have three today. And though I think all of my Sunday fun facts are pretty, you know, interesting, this one right here kind of, I can't explain it. Lego bricks withstand compression better than concrete. An ordinary plastic Lego brick is able to support the weight of 375,000 other bricks before it fails. This theoretically will let you build a tower nearing 3.5 kilometers in height. The problem is scaling these plastic bricks up to house-sized bricks would be far too expensive. But it's pretty cool. I mean, it's pretty fascinating stuff. All right, fun fact number two is the longest anyone has held their breath underwater is over 24.5 minutes. The world record for breath holding underwater was achieved by Croatian Budimir Sabat on 27 March 2021, which was only 3 years ago, who held his breath for a total of 24 minutes and 37 seconds. On average, a human can hold their breath between 30 and 90 seconds. So what's the secret? That sounds crazy to me. He can sit through an entire sitcom without taking a breath. That's insane. All right, and the last fun fact is something that's going to dispel a myth. People who eat whatever they want and stay slim have a slow metabolism, not a fast one. A skinny person tends to have less muscle mass than others. Their basal metabolic rate, BMR, is lower than those of a high muscle mass. This gives them a slow metabolism, not a fast one. That goes against everything that I've ever heard or ever believed, but, you know, supposedly it's a fact. Go with it. All right, and just like that, that is the end of our Sunday fun facts for today. I hope you learned something. I'll be back next week with three more that'll probably blow your mind. All right, it is time to get into the topic of today's show and why I am speaking to you today. We are celebrating Women's History Month, and in particular today on this show, the history of education and Black women in America. How Black women went from the absolute bottom on the education chart in this country and have collectively become the queens of education in America, ascending to the very top of the education chart in this country. So what I'm going to try to do now is give a brief history, and I say brief, a brief history of kind of how this education ball got rolling with Black women in this country. But I got to start at the beginning, because at the beginning there was no ball. So I got to start there. And, you know, the level of women's education in colonial America between 1492 and 1763 largely depended on race, class, and location. Although Caucasian girls from affluent families had the privilege to be taught by a governess or sent to a common school, the primary concern for educating a woman at that time was to make her skillful at household duties and a desirable product in the marriage market as well. However, slaves, both men and women, were banned from receiving any level of education. In fact, in 1740, North Carolina and other states passed the first laws to prohibit slave education. It was a crime punishable by death. Now, many Blacks, if they were allowed to read, were only permitted to read the Bible. Now, during this time, Phyllis Wheatley, if you remember, we spoke about her just a little bit ago, a Black slave, was marked as the most prominent example of an educated African-American woman. She became the very first published African-American woman, as we spoke of. She had 39 poems published in London, and it changed the views of a lot of Caucasians in this country as to exactly how smart Black women are. And largely because of Phyllis Wheatley, through the 19th century, higher education for women became more available. However, opening a school for African-American students was still condemned as an unacceptable stigma. For instance, in 1833, Prudence Crandall, a school teacher raised as a Quaker, was arrested and jailed for teaching African-American girls. Although Crandall later won the case on appeal, she ended up closing her school for fear that the outrageous attacks on the school would put her students' lives into jeopardy. But in 1837, Oberlin College, which was founded by Presbyterian ministers, began to admit African-American girls. Between 1835 to 1865, more than 140 African-American women attended Oberlin College, many of whom were former slaves. Most of these women took only a few classes to acquire basic literacy skills. Among them, 12 graduated from the ladies' course, which was not as rigorous as the bachelor's degree program, For example, it did not include the Latin, Greek, and Hebrew courses required for the full collegiate degree. But as we spoke of earlier, Mary Jane Patterson graduated in 1862 as the first African-American woman to earn a bachelor's degree. She subsequently went on to work her way up to become the principal of Dunbar High School in Washington, D.C. At the end of the Civil War, African Americans' education remained a highly controversial issue in southern states. For example, in 1869, Indiana became the first state to explicitly establish a separate set of segregated schools for its African American population. In 1896, the Supreme Court officially established the doctrine of separate but equal in the case of Plessy versus Ferguson. That lasted all the way to the middle of the 20th century, when several major Supreme Court decisions and legislation provided substantial opportunities for African Americans. In 1954, the Supreme Court overturned the findings of Plessy versus Ferguson with its landmark Brown versus the Board of Education, concluding that the doctrine of separate but equal is inherently unequal and unethical, and that it violated the equal protection of the laws guaranteed by the 14th Amendment. At the same time, two divided opinions about what kind of education African Americans should obtain emerged. W.E.B. Du Bois believed that African Americans were entitled to take the same courses and curriculums as white people in order to enhance the educational quality. But Booker T. Washington, on the other hand, in contrast, advocated for practical vocational training designed for African Americans. In line with Washington's theory, African American girls should have learned essential skills such as cooking, washing, and sewing, which was beneficial to them for the jobs that were available to them at the time. Following Washington's theory, Mary McLeod Bethune founded the Daytona Educational and Industrial School for African American Girls in 1904. The girls were taught basic academics and also learned how to do laundry, clean houses, make brooms, and raise chickens. Besides teaching academics and technical skills, however, Bethune also instilled in her students a sense of self-respect and confidence. She believed that girls were able to excel at everything they did in life, and over time, Bethune's school was expanded to a high school, junior college, and finally to a college that was renamed Bethune-Cookman University. And as you know, that college still exists today. Now, during the same time, a lady named Nanny Helen Burroughs started a similar school called the National Training School for Girls and Women in Washington, D.C. However, Burroughs stirred intense controversy that she required her students to take a course in African American history in order to educate black women about racism. After affirmative action took place in 1972, more positive steps were adopted to strengthen the reputation of women and minorities in employment, education, and culture, where they have been historically excluded. In 2014, a Pew Research Center analysis of U.S. Census Bureau data shows that females outpace males in college enrollment for the first time, in particular with Hispanics and African Americans. Fast forward to 2020, where black women hold 70% of all master's degrees and 60% of all doctorate degrees earned by black men and women in this country. And in proportion to their share of the overall population, the rate of black women getting degrees exceeds that of Latinas, Native Americans, Asian and Pacific Islanders, and Caucasians, which is why now black women are deemed the most educated group in the United States of America. Now, I know that was a lot of information in a short period of time, and I hope that you got most of it, but in a nutshell, black women are the shit. They are the prime example of it's not where you start, it's where you finish, and they are killing it. The whole term black girl magic is cute and all, but it's almost offensive to black women because I'm sure, as many black women will tell you, there's nothing magical about hard work. And being very honest, in researching this topic for this show, I have read many words to describe black women. Words like silent sufferers, perseverance, strength, courage, determination. All of these words I have read to describe black women in their plight, but I have yet to see the word magic. And you know, I shouldn't see that word as a description for black women and how they have progressed, because there's been nothing magical about what's happened. Black women over the centuries have just been dogged hard workers. They've outworked everybody else, and they deserve to be exactly where they are today, and that is at the top of that education chart. So here's to you, black women. You have worked your way from actually being considered less than a third class citizen in this country to being literally second to none. And you know, along those lines, again, celebrating Women's History Month, I wanted to rerun a segment that I did with the president of the National Medical Association, and her name is Dr. Yolanda Lawson. Now, it's a big deal being the president of the NMA because out of 124 presidents, Dr. Lawson is only the 10th woman to be elected into that position. So I had a pretty candid conversation about her and her role in the National Medical Association as a black woman president, but we also had candid conversation about women's health. So, there are some topics that we touched on that may not be suitable for young ears. I would say PG-13 is fine. So please, buckle up, sit back, and enjoy the conversation that I had with Dr. Yolanda Lawson, president of the National Medical Association. All right, 1500 family, please help me welcome to Let's Talk the new president of the National Medical Association, Dr. Yolanda Lawson. Good morning, Dr. Lawson. How are you?
Good morning. How are you?
I am so well. Thank you for being here with us today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me this morning.
Absolutely. Listen, you're going to help me shed some light on some things that not only am I curious about, but a lot of guys, and I'm sure some women are curious about, but most guys like me, we don't really have a whole lot of an idea of what women are talking about when they talk about these things. So you're going to help me with those today, okay?
Absolutely.
Okay. Now, first of all, president of the National Medical Association, that's a big deal. Like, how are you selected into that position?
So it is an elected position.
Okay.
I served at every level, from my local level to my state level, regional. So it's a work in progress, but it's an elected position. And to lead the black doctors and help lead advocacy for black patients in this country.
Okay. Now, when you say black doctors, so this is a black organization?
Yes. Yeah, so historically, black physicians were not allowed into the American Medical Association. So the National Medical Association was born out of a need for us to have a platform for our educational advances and for what you needed to get hospital privileges, right?
Right.
And so it was born out of the need for African-American physicians to have a platform and a place for that.
Wow. So even, that's crazy. So now, are black doctors now welcomed into the American Medical Association?
Yes, black doctors are welcomed into the American Medical Association. In the late 80s, the president of the AMA came to the National Medical Association in a public apology was provided to the black doctors. And so there are now reconciliation acts still going on to this day. As you can imagine, there was a lot of pain associated with those discriminatory acts in the past.
Okay. So now, are white members welcome into the National Medical Association?
Of course.
Okay.
Anyone who is in this fight to eliminate healthcare disparities is welcome into the National Medical Association.
Well, that's what's crazy to me, that there is still, I guess, a need for both. Like, I would assume, just like, you know, like baseball, like it, like things would, I don't know, integrate, and there wouldn't be a need for both, or there wouldn't still be a national and an American. You know, you guys are trying to, I guess, have the same success in taking care of medical issues. So it's kind of interesting to me. But it is a big deal, and obviously with this office that you hold now comes huge responsibility. So can you tell me the kinds of things or issues that you'll be tackling and managing in the position?
Absolutely. So I'll just highlight a few things. One is the Black Women's Health Agenda. And so I am an OBGYN by specialty. I practice also in Texas. And so maternal and reproductive health have been cornerstone to my career and history. And so that's one of my bucket areas. Okay. Also within that, cardiovascular disease, as you understand, leading cause of death in this country for all folks, but definitely when you began to discuss black folks and you look at black women are some of the most hypertensive beings on the planet.
Wow.
And then lastly, HIV. When you look at HIV, is a fifth leading cause of death in black women. And so black women also have some of the highest rates of new HIV infections. So some of these topics are within my black women's health agenda. Also digital health. And so we keep hearing about digital innovation and AI and how it's supposed to close these disparity gaps and help us, right?
Right.
I want to ensure that these innovations are not widening the disparity gaps, but actually closing those inequalities.
Okay.
And then lastly, the healthcare workforce, as you, I'm sure everyone heard, you probably have explored this over the past few years. You heard about burnout in physicians, and
yes,
especially after COVID.
Yes.
And I personally have lost colleagues who committed suicide.
Oh, wow.
And so when you hear that white doctors are burned out, what do you think is happening to our Black healthcare providers, physicians,
right,
nurses, pharmacists, all of that within the bucket?
I have a lot of work to do,
Brian.
Yeah, you do. Yeah, you do. But have you found any, or are you finding any pushback being a Black woman and having this title as president?
So I'm 2 weeks in. I don't think that I can say within this title yet I've experienced any pushback. I think that there have been some very strong women who have paved the way before me, and I appreciate and respect all of the work that has been done ahead of me.
Right.
But as a whole, and Black women, you know, if you think about the past 5 years, remember on the airline flight, the Black female doctor,
yeah,
tried,
I do,
to help resuscitate a patient and being questioned about being a doctor.
Yep.
One of my colleagues walked into a patient's room. She had her name with the letters MD on her white coat, and the white male patient asked her, "Oh, does that mean you're from Maryland?" And so you're right. We envision, right, when you think about who a doctor is. And so I am proud to step into this role and represent as a Black woman in this country and let people see my face and what that's associated with.
That is awesome. So at what age did you start becoming interested in medicine, but in particular gynecology? What got you interested in medicine and gynecology?
So I became interested in medicine in 10th grade. I remember taking physics, and I know that sounds strange, but physics, and I just began to fall in love with the life sciences. So I'm actually a zoology major, right?
Right.
So life sciences interested me. And so I knew by 10th grade I was going to pursue medicine. I went to medical school, and there were two things I was not going to do. I was not going to do pediatrics and OB. Those were two things I was not going to do. Okay.
Okay.
But again, I come from a family. I was the first doctor in my family, and it had to do with exposures. And so once I got into medical school and I got exposed, I fell in love with women's health.
Okay.
Women's health was it for me, and I knew it 100%.
Interesting. Interesting. Huh.
So it was a little bit of a curvy road, but, you know,
yeah, a little bit.
Yes, things become revealed to you.
Well, listen, it's been well documented, kind of like you mentioned before, that healthcare for Black people in this country have been historically far less adequate or available than for white people in the country. Is that still a huge disparity gap in 2023, or has it gotten better? Is it getting better?
As you know, there are still huge disparity gaps. We can start with, you know, I just alluded to HIV. HIV has now become a disease mostly in the South, and mostly those disparities are greatest between Black folks, not only in disease acquisition, access to PrEP therapy, access to treatment. I'm an OBGYN. You've heard a lot around maternal mortality.
Right.
How Black women, 3 times as likely to die. You could be well off, live in the suburbs, college educated. Those women are 5 times as likely to die as a Black woman. So even in that instance, right, where we hear this argument about the socioeconomic status, that's an instance where that doesn't even matter, right?
Right.
And so you look across many disease states. We're starting an initiative now around the mortality rate or the death rate of Blacks from cancer. You look at Black men, the death rates from prostate cancer. We look at colorectal cancer, breast cancer, Black women die more. And so all of these things, tremendous burdens on our community. So absolutely, Brian, there are still healthcare disparities, and we're working to address those daily.
Tell me about, because I know you know, you're the director of Abounding Prosperity, correct? And that addresses,
yes,
HIV disparities in the Black communities,
yes,
if I'm
yes,
correct, right? What are you doing, or what is your foundation doing? What are you doing to help that? Like, how do you address it? Like, what do you do?
Absolutely. You've done your research on me. So, yeah, Abounding Prosperity is a community-based organization here in Dallas, Texas. It's located in a medical desert or a medically underserved area. Many of our clients may be unfunded or not being uninsured. We knew that there was a gap. Previously, I'd started an HIV testing initiative that was faith-based in a zip code that had one of the highest rates of HIV in the Metroplex here. And so much of that work is about access, not only access to treatment, access to prevention methods like such as PrEP, you heard me talk about. We deliver transgendered care, and it's all about access and care. And how do these communities that are underserved, you keep hearing me say this underserved word, we get healthcare back into those communities?
Well, there are medical deserts in Black communities, and I think that's a huge issue. They talk about food deserts, which is true. But there are medical deserts also, and oftentimes Black folks don't have, they don't have the transportation. So if you're going into the communities, I mean, that's incredibly helpful, incredibly helpful.
It is absolutely. And so one of my passions is around access to care. I opened a birth center several years ago in a community. And so you think back historically, healthcare was in the community, right?
Right.
Now we are used to or accustomed to these large major centers or university centers where all the doctor's offices and the healthcare is in a center. And so you're right, there was something to it where healthcare and the doctor was in the community. I think back to the Cosby Show.
Right.
You remember he would go next door?
Had it in his basement. Yes, he did.
Right, in the basement.
In his basement, absolutely.
You remember that? So when I opened I could just remember him going next door, working and coming home.
Right.
Going back, being in the community.
Well, what's weird is when things were more segregated, and I've asked a couple of my guests this, who are activists within the Black community and older. And like my grandfather told me, he says he didn't know if integration was something that helped or hurt us more, because when things were more segregated, we were almost self-sufficient. We had teachers, we had doctors, we had all these things within our communities that we could depend on, and they were a phone call away. But it doesn't seem to be the case anymore. It's gotten a lot more difficult for us to get the care that we need.
It has. One of my mentors says the exact same thing. When we were self-sufficient, we relied on one another. And so you look at these things and these systemic and these large institutional structures, and you look at systemic racism. So absolutely, did you say that was your grandfather that said that?
Yes.
Your grandfather was a wise man. And so you think about this. My mother was just having this discussion with me the other day around, she went to a segregated high school.
Right.
And what that was like, having teachers who were personally vested in your education. And you felt that through and through.
Exactly. Now, are you trying to incorporate that same kind of personal care within your practice, where you kind of know who you're dealing with?
I have always had that approach. I have always had that approach. You know, I realize being a doctor, I'm part of a system, right?
Right.
I've worked in healthcare systems. And so when Black patients interface with those systems, I realize I'm a part of that system. I think that us in this country trying to get to racially concordant care, and you know what that is, Brian? That's when Black or like people are taking care of like. We know that studies have shown that when Black patients can get better outcomes with Black doctors, but you also know the gap and the disparity in the number of Black doctors, right? There's a larger Black population than Black doctors.
Absolutely.
So how do you get there? And so I've always had that approach, and always I feel many of my colleagues, that burden is on our shoulders. We have to do more for our patients. I have to almost overcompensate to ensure the care that they need. They get the care that they need.
You know, I don't know if this is true, but I have heard, and I kind of want to know, Are more C-sections performed on black women, and are they unnecessarily done than there are on white women?
Brian.
I'm sorry.
That can be the case, yes.
Okay.
That can definitely be the case. It can be multifactorial, right?
Okay.
You can look at, so I'll give an example. Black women, for instance, we have higher rates of preterm birth.
Okay.
Right? And so preterm birth is a complication of pregnancy. And so when you're thinking about preterm birth in itself, sometimes those babies aren't positioned properly. So in itself, with that being a complication of pregnancy, that could put you at a higher risk for cesarean. So there are just intricacies and nuances there that can impact the C-section rate among black women.
Okay.
And much of it has to do with having higher risk pregnancies. And then most commonly, what I love to talk about is the higher age women are getting pregnant now, right?
Right.
So women are delaying childbirth many times. And with delayed childbirth, the older you are, the more risk you have for complications such as preeclampsia and hypertension, and twins even are high. So higher risk at twins the longer you wait to get pregnant. So all of these are nuances.
Okay. All right. You know, you hear things and you don't know if it's fact-based or if it's just conspiracy. And I've heard that, and I heard a long time ago, and I always wanted to know if that is in fact was the case. So there are a couple of things. You know, when I mentioned to people that I was going to interview you today, they had a couple of questions. It was mostly men. All right. So help me out here, because we want to know. All right. One of the things is in regards to menopause and hot flashes. Is there anything that men can do to help women when they're going through hot flashes, and what causes it?
Okay. I love that question. So what causes menopause? I'm going to start there first. So when a girl is born, we're born with so many eggs, right? From the ovaries. Remember that seventh grade health class.
Right.
So you're born with so many eggs. All menopause is once your eggs are gone, then your ovaries basically fail. So it's ovarian failure is what menopause is by definition. The ovaries won't produce eggs anymore. That's why menstruation stops. And all of that creates the hot flashes and the vasomotor symptoms and the night sweats, right?
Okay.
And so it is a natural phenomenon. It is, I don't look at it as a disease state. I ask women to embrace the time. It is a change. And that's why they always called it, right? The change. You're going through the change.
Right.
And so
right.
It is a change. And I think men can be supportive.
Okay.
Right. I tell men all the time, you know, when it comes to the sweating, or she needs to have the fan on, she needs to have the AC, Lord, just get your blanket, but don't say anything.
Okay.
Right. And so
okay.
Support is needed, because, you know, when you're hot, and so you hear about women being irritable. Right. That's a common thing. And so many times, if you think about even a child, when you don't sleep well, you're irritable. And so the sleep disturbances because of becoming hot at night are very common. And so we think much of the irritability comes from purely just not sleeping well.
Lack of sleep. Okay, that makes sense. And what are the stages of menopause? Like there's menopause, perimenopause, like post, like what are the stages?
Right. So when we are in our child-rearing years, from the time we go through puberty, a woman is premenopausal. You're premenopausal all through your teens, 20s, 30s, 40s, whatever. The average age of menopause in the United States is around 51 and a half to 52 years age. And so when you're around the time of menopause, the Latin root of peri is around that. So it could be your late 40s, your perimenopause, right? So women just may only demonstrate some hot flashes. Their cycles may be a little bit irregular, but it takes usually about a 5-year process to get to menopause.
Oof.
So you become, then once you get to menopause, then you're considered postmenopausal. And that means you haven't had menstrual cycles for at least a year. Right.
Okay.
Most people will see their doctor by then because of the hot flashes or what have you. There are some women who have very little symptoms, and there are some women who have more than others. right?
Okay.
But it's usually about a 5-year process. You don't just wake up one day and you're in menopause. That would be an ugly trick, right?
That would
be. You're right. Mother Nature usually guides you through it. So it's a process. Again, that's why it's called the change.
Okay, now here's another one, okay? And it's a very sensitive concern that affects women and ultimately affects her partner, as in us,
okay.
Right?
Okay.
It's vaginal odor. What are the primary causes and remedies or preventive care for that? And what can men do, what can we do to help lessen those things?
So if there's one thing folks should walk away with, a vaginal odor is not normal. And if you have one, please see a healthcare professional, because many times people seek over-the-counter methods, right?
Okay.
So I encourage folks, if it is the man and he notices it, he says something to you. I often ask the patients, has he noticed it? And so if you have that, please seek care for it first, because the first thing everyone's going to be concerned about, of course, is some type of infection. And so we want to control if it's sexually transmitted or not. We want to discern that. Not all causes of vaginal odor are sexually transmitted, but you want to make sure it's not, because
okay.
We want to control disease states for men and for women, right?
Right.
And then secondly, again, get testing to see what it actually is. Too many times people presume, and people are pursuing over-the-counter methods, boric acid and all these other things that are sold over-the-counter, douches, and which can aggravate the problem. You may get temporary relief, but it will come back.
Okay.
And so we do not recommend those things. So it's so important to understand, because you can complicate your diagnostic picture by not seeking care earlier and using these other things to mask your condition.
Are there, how can I ask this question? Are there differences in men and women to the point where you could be, I guess, in a relationship with someone who's throwing your pH off as a woman? Like, how do you remedy that? Because I hear that pH balance is such an important ingredient to having a healthy vagina. So is it something where a man can actually be throwing that off by like soaps he's using or lotions he's using? Like, is that a thing?
So first I want to clarify, usually the soaps and the lotions are not the culprit.
Okay.
If you have some type of infection, you can then have a pH balance change. We know infection will create a pH balance change. There are things that you can do, of course, that can affect your pH balance. You just heard me say douching, probably
right.
The most common. Right?
Okay.
There are bacteria everywhere on the body and the skin. You can't control that. There are good bacteria and bad bacteria in the vagina. The vagina is an open orifice, just like your mouth is.
Right.
Right?
Right.
An open orifice. We all know there are bacteria in our mouth. Right?
Right.
And so when you douche and you wash out, right, the bad bacteria, you also wash out the good bacteria and you create changes in pH balance, and then you can allow the bad bacteria to take over, hence the odor and bacterial vaginosis and all these other conditions, right?
Right.
And so many times women may say, oh, it's soap, I can't use, you know, soap with fragrance and things like that. Well, typically you've been using soap probably your whole life. Your mother bathed you in soap, things like that. So there
right.
can be harsher soaps. I don't advise, but typically there can just be something underlying. Typically, it's not that soap is necessarily causing it.
Okay.
But I know that that is a thought that and a myth that is propagated all the time.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
I'm very, very aware.
Okay.
And so in regards to men, yes, men can have non-sexually transmitted infections also. So typically, I'll give you an example. When it may not be diagnosed until fertility. I'm looking at a gentleman's semen analysis, and I'll see things, cells that fight bacteria. He may not have had any symptoms at all. His partner may be the person who presents with recurring vaginal infections and odor, right?
Okay, I got you.
And so, yeah, it can be stemmed from a man. So typically, you know, getting him treatment, using condoms for a while to allow both reproductive systems to recover is very important.
So men can be the carrier of something that they have no idea they have, and women become the incubator of that because it's inside and it's moist.
That's an interesting word, incubator. It has to do with our anatomy. Again, the inside of the vagina is like the inside of your mouth. There is no skin layer. The man's anatomy, because the penis has skin, right? That's why women are always more susceptible. It has to do purely based with our anatomic structures.
Okay. Well, on that same subject, tell me about HPV, and do you believe that young women should get the HPV vaccine?
Yes, I'm so glad, because again, here we are talking about anatomic structures and HPV. So that's why it's much easier for a man to transfer HPV to a woman than a woman to a man, just again, based on the skin and mucosal membrane anatomy of the vagina versus the penis. I do believe in the HPV vaccine. When you look at cervical cancer rates now, again, cervical cancer rates are higher in Black women.
Okay.
But we have tools such as the HPV vaccine that not only can protect you against cervical and vaginal cancer. People forget there are things such as vaginal cancer, vulvar cancer, the skin on the outside of a woman. But even for men, esophageal cancer, rectal cancer. So I when there are tools and things that we can use to cut down these disparities, cut down disease, reduce people dying, then yes.
Okay.
We want to advocate for that.
Okay.
And especially now, remember, before we could only give you the vaccine up until you were 26 years of age. And now we expanded the age range. We waited on the research and the studies to come out. And so I remember when it first came out, Brian, I had men calling my office. People wanted it. And so it's an important thing that now we are vaccinating both men and women.
Oh, wow.
HPV causes penile cancer. It is the cause of cancer of the penis. And so it's an important thing for men's health also.
Now, is there a certain age that you don't need it, or you just, you know what I mean? But I think younger people are more susceptible than older. Is a cutoff 45 or 50 or 50? Like, what is the cutoff? Or is there one?
The cutoff is 40.
Okay.
And yes, young women and girls definitely can be more susceptible. Women are, as I stated, more susceptible. The immune system changes. So that's why we would tell people, if you got HPV, if you contracted HPV and you were 30 years or older, the likelihood of it resolving was very high. It would not. You'd likely have it. Right?
Okay.
If you're younger and you get HPV, it can act as a transient infection sometimes, right? If you're in your early 20s, late teens, it may go away. There is a chance it may go away. But if you're 30, you don't, because we don't consider that old, but the immune system is always changing per our age.
Okay. I dated someone that had a problem with fibroids, and it really did affect our physical intimacy. What are fibroids, and is there any truth that Black women are more susceptible to getting them than white women, and why?
Yeah, absolutely. So Black women are more susceptible. So women of African descent, it has to do with our African heritage. So women of African descent, but however, Asian women, Caucasian women, any woman can get fibroids. It's just more common in women of African descent. Fibroids are tumors of the uterus. So the uterus is, or the womb, right, is a organ made of muscle. And fibroids are typically tumors made of muscle.
Okay.
So I just first want to ground and root every people. Fibroids grow from the uterus, because people think the ovaries and, you know, the structures of the woman's reproductive system can be confusing to folks. So they are tumors that grow from the uterus. Most commonly they cause menstrual issues or bleeding, but they also can cause pain, back pain. Pain with intercourse.
Right.
And so, but very common. But there are treatments available. Not always surgery is needed. It's distinctly dependent on where the fibroids are. So that's why an assessment with a gynecologist is so important when you have those.
Yeah, it I think a lot of men are lost in that women become emotional and they become very insecure. Or it's very difficult emotionally for women when they're going through this, especially when it causes pain and bleeding, because guys are impatient. And I think the biggest thing that I learned from it is to be patient and be empathetic. Because it's a thing that men never have to go through. And I didn't know anything about it until I experienced it with this person.
I would love for you to say that again. Be patient and what else?
Empathetic.
Be empathetic. There you go. Be patient, be empathetic. Because for a woman for childbearing purposes and for her future reproduction. And so fibroids don't always preclude that. Again, it's very important to understand with your physician where, you know, the location, the size of the fibroids, a full assessment needs to be done. Right. Sometimes we do nothing about them. They could be small and asymptomatic. It could be years before a woman even knows she has them. But, of course, it can be a very sensitive issue for women to deal with and manage.
Certainly was. I learned the hard way because I wasn't patient and I wasn't empathetic. So I had to learn that. So full disclosure.
As long as you learn.
I learned. All right, so let's switch gears a bit, okay? I want to talk about something that came out recently. And according to the CDC, about 14% of black people in the country over the age of 65 have Alzheimer's, compared to only 10% of white people. Why is that the case?
So this is something we are actually exploring within the organization. We're looking not only at the increased risk of Alzheimer's. So one of the issues that we have, again, is the reluctance of Black people to enroll in clinical trials and clinical research so we can gain more insights and answers around these types of things. So we know that, again, you and I started out this conversation talking about healthcare disparities, mm-hmm. right? Okay. This is another area where we see that disparity with Black people. It could be some due to other comorbidities. We know that hypertension and other disease states can contribute to your dementia risk, right?
Right.
We know that lifestyle can contribute to your dementia risk. Family history, genetics, so all these interplay, but there's definitely more push to get more Black patients enrolled in clinical research so this can be thoroughly studied. And then we also look at the access to treatment. We know that early intervention when there's dementia is also a very key and important role when you think about the progression of the disease.
So when you talk about dementia, I thought that was something that progressed on its own. It's not something that you could slow down or stop. Is that not the case?
There are treatments that you can slow down and stop dementia. As you know, there are different types of dementia.
Okay.
Most people are very common with Alzheimer's. There's dementia could be caused by prior strokes and other things, vascular disease. But yes, there are treatments and methods, and we know lifestyle, you know, not smoking, exercising regular. There are things that we can do to help reduce our risk for dementia also. And so that's why I'm a big proponent on preventive health, especially for our communities.
Well, we've heard all kinds of things. It has to do with Black people's diets. I don't know if that's the case. It's drinking sodas, eating a lot of processed foods. It seems like the medical community kind of grasp at things when it comes to, no offense to you, but I'm just trying to figure out, is there anything other than access to care, healthcare, which is a big thing, is there anything else that's across the board that, you know, maybe we could do to help prevent that in the Black community?
It's prevention, right?
Okay.
It's the prevention and the control and the management of your diabetes. It's the prevention and the control of your hypertension and taking your meds so you don't have a stroke. And it's the prevention and control of all those two things, which can also lead to chronic kidney disease and all those other morbidities and disease states that we suffer from more commonly that can contribute, right, to that. And so, again, that's why prevention, compliance with your meds, and doing what you can do optimally for your own personal health are so important.
It alarmed me because, you know, although you're in Dallas, I'm based out of Baltimore, and mm-hmm. the highest numbers of dementia in the cities, with Baltimore being one of them, and Miami-Dade County, Florida, and the Bronx, New York. Where does that come from?
So when it came to those cities, so we knew when, you know, the East and the Southeast had higher rates of Alzheimer's dementia. And then you're right, Baltimore City, Miami, some of it had to do with age, aging population.
Okay.
That was a big year for Baltimore. Also, Black and Hispanic populations, another large contributor when you come to it. But what I hope we can walk away from getting that information from that study is that there are going to be resources, allocation, and more research into why.
Okay.
Right? We know some of it, right? We know some of it when you talk about Black communities and other healthcare issues. But we really begin to dive in and now really begin to have another elevated conversation about the why.
Okay.
Exactly, because you know, anyone who lives in Baltimore is going to be like, why? What is it? Is there
exactly.
a water? Is it, you know,
right,
question
right.
that. I really hope that your state health departments and all of that really work collaboratively on really getting that information out. You know, they have data, they have resources, they have some insights. You know, it took external this study to be done, but we hope that there will be answers that come back to that community to help them protect themselves.
What are a couple of the signs, and I know I'm taking up your time, but what are a couple of the signs that my listeners can look for in their grandparents or in their parents that might be a sign if they are suffering from dementia?
Absolutely. I have a really, my favorite human in the world is my uncle, and my family is going through it now. And our first bout was, you know, he got lost. Driving every day, taking care of himself, and he literally got lost.
Okay.
And couldn't get back home. And so, of course, we know that forgetfulness, that may start with just, where did I put my keys, and misplacing things, recall. And we know we're all going to get some of that with age, but again, speaking up with it, sometimes going with that person to the doctor, making sure they're sharing, right?
Right.
Many times, it's the advocacy of the family that helps get not only diagnosis, but begin to start treatments to retard the progression of dementia. So it's very important. Sometimes you accompany those older family members to the doctor. Invaluable.
Now, this is going to be the last question, I promise you. But if I didn't ask you this, I wouldn't be doing my job. You are in one of the most stringent abortion law states in the country. How is that affecting you as a gynecologist and what you tell and do for your patients, or is it?
It does affect what a gynecologist does for their patient here in Texas. And I think my challenge with all of this is the framework around abortion. And so it's come to a place where people ideally think of abortion maybe as just, you know how you talked about earlier, what we ideally see as a picture of who the doctor is,
yes,
but who's getting the abortion. And I think people forget how complex a decision that is.
Right.
People forget married couples sometimes seek abortion. It's not always just this Black teenage girl that's pursuing an abortion.
Right.
And so I think the framework around abortion, who gets abortion, and what is abortion. Abortion is healthcare. And so I frame this in termination of pregnancy, right?
Right.
And so pregnancy can be terminated for health concerns of a baby, for health concerns of a mother. And when I say a baby, I'm talking about a baby that may not survive or has a condition. I remember had a patient that the baby was forming without a head, right? No
right.
brain,
right.
No head. We know that that is a condition that is not going to be compatible with life, but to make her proceed and carry a pregnancy all the way without allowing her the grace or the option to terminate early, it reduces her risk for cesarean, hemorrhage, and all those other complications. Because whether you're pregnant with a normal baby or not, you can still get complications of pregnancy. All the body knows is you're pregnant,
right?
Right?
Right.
And so framing it in as healthcare and the nuances and the complications we as obstetricians see versus how it's simply put out, you know, just people, we're not advocating for abortion, but we want people to have access because what's been so limiting is the care women may need for miscarriage, ectopic pregnancies, all these other things have been mired in controversy because of the ruling. So it's very complicated here.
Doesn't sound like it's gotten any better either. That's unfortunate.
No, it's not gotten any better.
Well, listen, thank you so much for your time. And I'm going to call on you again. I hope you know that.
Anytime. Anything that I can do to help. I care about community. I care about, I'm looking for a healthy Black America. That is my prayer every night. So thank you for having me today.
Thank you. The new president of the National Medical Association, Dr. Yolanda Lawson. You take care of yourself, okay?
Thank you. Have a great day.
You Bye-bye. Do the same. Bye-bye. All right, well, that was my interview with Dr. Yolanda Lawson last year, a few months ago, and it's still an appropriate thing to run today because education and the way that women have stepped up and taken roles in medicine, I mean, it's second to none as far as Black women go, so I wanted you guys to hear that. But I know you hear the music. It is time for the Petty, so let's give him a call and see what he's talking about today.
Good morning, Brother B. How are you?
I'm good, brother. How you doing today?
I'm doing just great.
Good. What you got for me today?
Man, oh man. I don't think you have enough time in your show for things I have. I'm telling you. Free agency frenzy started Monday, and let me tell you something. When I say that the NFL is 24/7, 365, boy, has it been this past week.
Yeah, but it's been painful, man. I mean, it's been for the Ravens, man. For me, it's been painful. I didn't want to see OBJ go. I didn't want to see Queen go. You know, I'm glad we got Henry, but dang.
I was getting ready to see you jumping the gun. I didn't even get a chance to
I'm talk sorry, about man. I'm sorry, bro. It's just been painful, man.
I know it's been painful. Devin DuVernay is gone. OBJ is gone. Patrick Queen is gone. But you got the king. Oh, Henry! Coming to the Baltimore Ravens. And you tomorrow, the running game is going to be fantastic and on fire. Man, I'm telling you, Brother B, that's going to open up your offense so much. I mean, you got a stud receiver, Jose Flowers.
Right,
you know,
right.
He's going into his second year. You have a bona fide. And I mean, you got Gus the Bus is gone, too. You forgot about Gus Williams.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
You know, but man, Derrick Henry, I don't know how you guys pulled that off. But
yeah, I know.
Everybody say, you know, he kind of lost the step. He's not. That man's powerful. Behind a powerful line like the Ravens offensive line, and I mean just the offense itself, you know, your offensive coordinator is gonna have a lot to work with. I'm pretty sure he is salivating. He's probably sitting around thinking about all the plays he can come up with for that team and that offense. And I man look.
Yeah dog, but how do you get rid of a Patrick Queen, bruh?
Well,
I mean, he had the amount of tackles that cat had last year, good grief.
The odd thing is that he's going to a team that's your rival.
Yeah, I know.
And he's gone from wanting to fight Cousin Mike to playing for Cousin Mike.
Right.
How ironic is that?
Right.
And speaking of those Steelers, Russ is going to be cooking in Pittsburgh.
I heard. What do you think about that, man? How do you think that's going to play out for him?
I think it's going to play out very well for him. I think that's a good fit for him. I think it may have been a thing where Sean Payton did not want Russell Wilson to be his quarterback. Because if you look at his stats, Russell Wilson didn't fall off that much.
No, he didn't.
You know, you really got to look at him and compare his stats with Seattle and with Denver. And it's got to be something else that was going on there because I think he may have been a good fit. I really didn't like him in Denver. But I think it could have worked out. I just don't think Sean Payton wanted him to be his quarterback.
Right.
And the bad thing is that Denver still has to pay the bulk of that salary, and the Steelers are getting him for a steal.
I know.
And I'm talking about the steal. I'm talking about out of all the money that's owed to Russell Wilson, the Steelers only have to pay $1.2 million of that.
Oh, my God.
The Broncos pick up the rest of the tab.
Wow.
Which is a little over $38, $39 million. Woo. That's crazy.
I would have made it work. If I'm management with the Denver Broncos, I'm telling Sean Payton to make that work. You make it work some kind of way.
Yeah, well, it didn't work. And not to mention, staying with the Steelers for a minute, they also traded Kenny Two Gloves Pickett to the Eagles, and they picked up Justin Fields. And I'm thinking they're looking at, towards their future. And they picked up Justin Fields, who's still in his rookie contract. So they're getting two quarterbacks
for nothing.
For steal.
Yeah.
And, you know, he can sit behind Russell Wilson and possibly learn something.
Exactly.
I mean, I think the talent is there. I think he's going into a good organization. I mean, the young man really wasn't given a chance. You're talking about playing for the Bears, and you saw some improvement last year. And, you know, when you're playing for a team and you have three different offensive coordinators, different coaches, different offensive schemes, how are you supposed to be successful just coming out of college? There are flashes there with this young man. He has it.
Oh, I agree.
He just has to get with the right organization.
I agree.
So, you know, and like I said, talking about this free agent thing, you're talking about Captain Kirk Cousins going to the ATL.
Yep.
Man, that is something. And this is what's really, really strange. They're giving Kirk Cousins a whole lot of money. And he's not a bad quarterback. He hasn't won anything.
He's got great stats, though.
He has some, his stats are awesome. But they have the opportunity to pay your quarterback, Lamar Jackson. And Lamar Jackson is considerably younger than Kirk Cousins. He's more healthy than Kirk Cousins. Kirk Cousins is coming off of Achilles injury.
Right, right.
At his age.
Right. They don't heal very well at his age.
No, and you're going to give him that money. So,
wow.
Let's see how that works out.
Wow. What about
Keenan Allen? Here's another one. And I think there's been so many names out there. Like I said, we don't have enough time to talk about how many free agents. Here's a big one for me. Keenan Allen, who's played his whole career with the Chargers, who wanted to stay a Charger, is going to the Bears.
Huh?
Yeah, he's free agency. I'm telling you, Brother B, it's been a wild free agent week. I mean, the signings are just crazy.
I see that Sam Howell's going to Seattle, and I'm trying to figure out who is Washington going to pick up to be their starting quarterback now.
That is a very good question. And, you know, we're talking about this. Everybody's thinking that Caleb Williams, now that Justin Fields is gone from the Bears, that the Bears will pick Caleb Williams. And he said he does not want to play in Chicago.
Right.
He said it. I don't want to play for you guys. They still might pick him anyway. They still might do a pick and trade. And I think he wants to play in Washington. So we got to see. Next month is draft day.
Right.
Next month is draft month. Some things will be playing out.
Right.
Players are moving here. They're moving there. And teams now have to start looking at what their needs are. And Washington definitely needs a quarterback.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
It's a possibility Caleb Williams may go to the Commanders.
Yeah, Commanders just don't do well with rookie. They just don't do well with young quarterbacks, though. They ruin them. It's just weird.
Well, they had a nice rookie quarterback, and I think they forced him back on the field a little too soon. I'm talking about RG3. You know, he was injured.
Yeah.
There was in a playoff position, they forced him back. I honestly believe if they did not force him back on the field, that he would have been a very good quarterback for the Commanders. I think if they would have found a way to keep Kirk Cousins, he would have been a good quarterback for the Commanders.
Right.
So they've had their chances.
Taylor Heineke, they had a chance with him.
And they let him walk.
Let him walk.
You know? So I think they're going to try to develop a quarterback through the draft. And like I said, draft is coming up next month, and there's going to be a whole lot of stuff going on. But you know, one team I'm looking at, the Jets are making some moves very quietly, and I think they're trying to build up their offensive line and some parts of their defense. But when I say about the offensive line, because they stole an all-pro offensive lineman from the Cowboys. So I think they're looking for some protection for Aaron Rodgers.
Right, right.
We're going to see how he looks coming off his Achilles injury from last season. So the Jets are making some moves. And I'm telling you right now, I'm looking at some of the moves the Jets are making. And if they can't win this year, I think Robert Saleh will be out. He will be done. He will be finished. He's out of there. The one thing I've noticed about a lot of players that are jumping to other teams during this free agency week is that some of them have decided that, no, you will not restructure my contract. I'm not taking deferred payments. I'm not taking pay cuts. I'll go somewhere else. And I think that's why we're seeing so many players jump around from team to team to team.
Well, let me ask you this, man. Who do you think What do you think the Lions need to be better than they were last year to finally make it to a Super Bowl? What's the missing piece for them?
It's definitely somewhere on the defense. Me personally, after looking at a lot of their games, and I like the Lions. You know I like the Lions.
Oh,
I
yeah.
The Kentucky Lions, I like them. I really think it's the defensive backfield. I think they gave up too many passing yards. They can hang with anybody.
Right.
They're a very good team. I think it has a lot to do with their inexperience. They're young.
Yeah.
So, you know, they will learn from their mistakes. Hopefully they'll go back and look at some of the games where it's a learning process. They'll look back at some of the games where they failed when they should have succeeded. And, I really think it's the youth and the inexperience and, you know, trying to get a real good veteran, maybe two, in that defensive backfield. They look pretty good on the defensive line. They don't look too bad in the linebacker position. But, man, their corners, they were getting toasted several times.
Yeah.
So I think that's their biggest weakness. I like their offense. I think they'd be right back in the mix again in the NFC.
Okay.
I think you can almost say that it's going to be a two-team fight in the NFC North, and I'm talking about Green Bay and Detroit. The Bears are going to kind of rebuild it. And now with Kirk Cousins gone from the Vikings, it's like they're rebuilding also.
Right,
so
right.
So we talk about the NFC North, and we're only talking about basically – Detroit Lions and the Green Bay Packers.
Okay.
And the NFC West has gotten a little weaker because one of their best defensive players, and a lot of people say he may have been the best defensive lineman in NFL history, Aaron Donald, has decided to hang him up.
Yeah, I saw that he retired. Yeah.
And a lot of teams are saying, thank God, we don't have to worry about the Rams anymore.
Right.
That guy.
Right.
And on a side note, the Rams went out and did something I felt was just, I don't know, maybe because of his knowledge of certain teams in the NFC. They went out and signed Jimmy Garoppolo as the backup behind Matthew Stafford. So that was kind of weird and strange.
Huh.
I don't know about that one there.
Tell me what's going on with getting out of the free agency thing. Tell me what's going on with Dak, man, and the sexual assault or sexual molestation thing he's got going on.
We're going to stay mums on that until more information is put out there. Look, these guys are putting themselves in some very, very strange, weird, unfortunate positions because of their status. They should know that people will come at them in the least little thing that they do.
Right.
That's what happened with Zay Flowers.
Yeah.
The least little thing, and all of a sudden, it's domestic violence, it's sexual assault, it's something, and you have to be able to protect yourself.
I mean, this woman's trying to get $100 million from Dak. She's trying to get $100 million.
I said,
what?
Let's try to keep that under wraps. You know, I don't like the cowgirls. Let's try to keep that under wraps to be a little more information. And when some more stuff come out, then we're gonna put that out there. And you know, Dak Prescott shenanigans. The one thing Dak should be worried about or thinking about more than anything is trying to get over the hump of winning a playoff game or two.
I agree.
Or three. So all the other nonsense, and if it keeps him out of the game because of the investigations that they do in the NFL, then you can say Cowboys won't be doing anything this season.
Yeah, yeah.
So we'll see. That's, you know, to be continued.
All right.
Later on this afternoon, those brackets will be coming out, Brother B. It is March Madness. It's that time. And you know what? I don't know who's going to be the favorite coming out of the men's division. There's a lot of upsets. There are a lot of good teams on the men's side. And it's just hard for me to tell. I can't say this team is the favorite coming out of the men's division.
I agree with you. There's a lot of parity now that a lot of guys are playing 1 or 2 years and going to the NBA. It doesn't allow for dynasties like there used to be.
Exactly. And, you know, it's they're getting them young.
Yeah,
and, they are. I mean, the NBA, they do what they do. And, if they, and I mean, they've been getting guys out of high school for years. So of course they're going to catch a lot of guys in their freshman, coming out of their freshman year or their sophomore year, and it kind of waters down the NCAA as far as the men's division go, and that's where you're starting to see a lot of parity there. Well, it used to be, like you said, some dynasties with North Carolina, with Duke, Indiana,
Georgetown, all those guys.
Villanova. You know, we're not seeing that anymore.
No, we're not.
And I mean, it's kind of fun if you know, if you like parity. And the only place I like parity, to be honest with you, is in football.
I like it in the boxing ring myself, but, you know.
Well, yeah, well, boxing too.
Right.
So as far as, you know, basketball, football, baseball, hockey, I want to see my parity in the NFL.
Right.
The NCAA, I like seeing it now because there's really no strong, strong team and no strong, strong school. And I like that because that gives young men coming out of high school the option to say, well, I'll go here or I'll go there. So saying, well, I want to play for that school because they're a powerhouse. Now they're looking at it like, well, maybe I can do something over here because they're up and coming. Well, they're
right.
Pretty good. So I like to have, I like seeing the priority in the NCAA in the men's division. Now, because it's still National Women's Month, let's talk about the women. And I got to say, my favorite coming out of the women's division has got to be South Carolina.
Okay.
Now, speaking of South Carolina, and what could be an upcoming rival, a rivalry, LSU.
Oh, yeah. It's definitely a rivalry.
Everybody saw it.
Everybody
saw the skirmish, the befuffle. I mean, we saw the brouhaha. We saw it. But let me tell you that I saw it, that maybe a lot of other people didn't see. Well, maybe they did see it. Sometimes you can talk the talk, but you got to walk the walk. And this person kind of talked the talk, but they walked away from the skirmish that was happening.
Oh, man. You talking about Angel Reese?
Angel Reese.
Come on,
you
man.
You know what I'm talking about, her. She walked away. When everybody's ready to go ahead and throw down, she's like, nope, not me. But she's still running her mouth. We'll see him again. Whoever wants to see us, they better be scared. Girl, please.
Yeah, but the reason she walked away was because she didn't want to be. She wanted to play. I mean, that was a smart move. It was a smart move. Protect your brand and protect your ability to play in the games.
You know what? Sometimes I like the villain. This was her chance. They've already painted her as the villain.
Yeah.
This is a chance. Y'all say I'm the bad girl. I'm going to show y'all, yeah, I am that bad girl. Now, that's just me.
Right.
You're absolutely right.
Right.
I agree with you. She walked away, which was the smart thing to do. But if you want to talk the talk, sweetie, you better walk that walk. And I think that's one of those times she could have walked the walk. Like, look. Yeah, I'm that, you know what.
Right,
and
right.
She walked away. But I think she's going to be an excellent player with some recent WNBA, and she's definitely going to go there. I think we're going to start seeing a whole lot more tight games between those two because South Carolina, man, even though they're winning, they're just barely pulling out games.
Yeah.
And there's a possibility they may get upset. I don't think so. I think they're going to go ahead and take the whole thing because they're finding ways to win. Tennessee had them. Tennessee had them dead to right.
Yeah.
And we're talking about a player who has never hit a three-point in her college career.
Not even attempted one.
She's never made a three-point shot. And she's
right.
A center.
Right.
And she happened to pull it out for South Carolina. And if you look at that tape, they didn't even guard her.
Nope.
Just like they was like, go ahead and shoot it. We don't care. And what does she do? She drains it. Off glass. Game over. South Carolina gets the undefeated.
And the crazy thing was, it didn't look like a brick. It looked like she's been shooting them all her life. The form was great. She knew exactly where to shoot from.
She caught it. She stepped behind the line, and she fired that thing up like, didn't hesitate at all.
Not at all. I was like, wow.
But I think we're starting to see something in women's basketball as far as a rivalry between LSU and South Carolina.
Right, right.
And that's good for women's sports. You know, I really think that's very, very good for them. Hopefully we'll start to see a little bit more of the WNBA because I don't hear too much about it. I just hear more about what's going on in the NCAA than the WNBA.
Well, I think
Caitlin Clark's.
I think just like when Magic and Bird saved the NBA, I think Caitlin and Angel are going to do the same thing for the WNBA. They need names coming out of college that people recognize going into the pros. Right now, nobody recognizes any of the names that are in the pros. But when they have kids that they can follow through college that were stars, or superstars that are going into the pros. I think that's what will lift that league up.
And as you already know, that Caitlin Clark decided that she will go into the draft for the WNBA for next season.
Yes.
So that's something to look forward to.
Definitely.
Hopefully Angel Reese will do the same thing.
Absolutely.
And that will be a big rivalry.
It will.
So those are two big names that will be in the WNBA, and I think people will really start to watch that.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Moving right along. Speaking of the NBA, we're getting close to playoff time, and one thing I've noticed is that the West looks a little different now. We're talking about OKC, New Orleans Pelicans, the Clippers, even though the Clippers are a little long in the tooth with all those old guys, but I'm seeing a lot of young talent in the NBA now and different teams. It's not just the Lakers and Golden State and Houston. We're talking about some young teams of Minnesota and Memphis and like I said, the Clippers. And what are they going to do about Jokic?
I don't know.
Killing.
Yeah, they can't stop him. I mean, he dropped 31 against, I think, Wimby the other night.
Yeah, he did. So, you know, it's a little bit of a changing of the guard, and I kind of like that. You know, we're tired of seeing the same old things happening out west.
I agree.
And that's a good thing. I think that's a good thing for the NBA. It, you know, these people are interested in making them want to watch some games now, and I kind of like that.
Right.
I really do. And as you know, we're a couple of weeks away from, as a matter of fact, I do believe baseball starts next Thursday. Not this coming Thursday, but I believe it's the 28th of this month, Thursday night.
Okay.
Major League start. And, it seems like baseball starting earlier and earlier every year. I just remember baseball being in April.
That's what I remember, baseball. Too. Yeah.
But now we're talking about late March. And here's the funny thing, Brother B. They pushed it back where they're starting that first game like in the last week of March. But it's going all the way to almost Thanksgiving with the World Series.
But I think that's why they started it early, because it was getting later and later into the fall season and players were complaining about the cold. So hopefully them starting it early, these 3 weeks early or 2 weeks early, will help that a little bit.
Now, here's a little twist. You know, you have the Summer Olympics coming up this summer.
Right.
And baseball will be part of the Summer Olympics, from what I understand.
That's right.
And they're trying to find a way to get the pro baseball players to be part of the Olympics.
How are they going to do that, though?
That is a very good question. No one has an answer for it, but they're going to try to find a way. And one of the things they said is that, well, you know, you have your All-Star break. Why don't we, you know, try to get some games in or try to have some matches during the All-Star break?
I don't know. But if they don't find a way to do it, Cuba and Puerto Rico and Japan is going to kill us.
No question.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, they're just powerhouses. But then again, if they did put some of the pro athletes in the baseball segment of the Olympics, you have a lot of Dominican players, you have a lot of you have a lot of Dominican, Puerto Rican, and Asian players that could play for their country.
Very true.
I still think they would probably get killed.
We
have some very good American players, don't get me wrong.
I agree.
We do. But, you know, if you look, they've signed a whole lot of pitchers from out of Japan lately.
They really have.
We're not even going to talk about what the Dominican has put out as far as infielders and star players.
Right.
You know, so, and Puerto Rico.
Right.
So, hey, I don't know about if the pros played for the U.S. in the Olympics. It's a definite.
I agree.
So, we're going to be looking at that. Hockey is moving right along. I know I usually talk about the Golden Knights. But there have been a lot of young players coming into the NHL, and I like it. It's a little bit of parody going on in the NHL right now, and I kind of like that. But, you know, I'm going to stick with those Golden Knights. They are the NHL defending champions. I expect them to be back in the Stanley Cup round again. And as time goes on, we'll be keeping up with them. I know some of your listeners probably aren't big NHL fans, but it's part of the sports world, so we're going to keep up with it. And finally, the UFL, which I have not talked too much about, they will be starting up on the 29th of March. And so next week, we're going to talk a little bit more extensively about the UFL. I can tell you this much.
What's that?
On opening day for the UFL, United Football League.
Right.
The USFL champion will be playing the XFL champion for the very first game season.
That's opening. Awesome.
That much I do know.
That's awesome.
And so we'll be start talking more about that. I hope that, you know, the DC Defenders can make some noise this year in the UFL. And maybe I'll be able to get a chance to fly down to DC and maybe catch a game.
Sounds good.
I can tell you this much. I will be coming down to Baltimore to watch those high flying O's. As a matter of fact, they'll be playing the Philadelphia Phillies down in Baltimore. So I will definitely make the trip down there for that game and maybe a couple of other ones.
Okay.
And hopefully the O's will be back on track. And speaking of the O's, finally, just one last note. I'm surprised that they signed Craig Kimbrel to be their closer, their setup man, or whatever role he'll play in their bullpen. Because if you remember the World Series, Philadelphia had it won. And this dude came in and he blew two games for them. So to think that the Orioles picked him up, maybe they don't think Batista will be back in time. I don't know. But that's the kind of surprise to me that they picked him up. But I still think the O's are going to do something nice where they might not have to use him that much.
All right. Okay.
On that note, Brother B, I am out of here. I have some more news for you next week, some more signings that will be coming up. And like I said, more information on the UFL.
Sounds good,
bro. Enjoy your Sunday. Enjoy this wonderful weather that we're having. I am out of here. Peace.
Peace, brother. Peace. All right. It's always fun talking to the Petty, but it is that time. The hour has come to a close. It's always the fastest time of my life, this 1 hour on Sundays. I appreciate you joining me today. If you've missed any portion of the show or any of the shows, or you want to share it with your family and friends, please, please, please check out my website, voiceswired.com. Hit the Let's Talk tab. You'll see all of my shows listed there from newest to oldest. Also, I love to have your feedback. As I always say, it helps the show grow. It helps me get better. And it helps me choose topics. So hit me at On with Brian Pettaway on Instagram. Let me know what you think. Drop me a line. I promise to get back to you. But until that time, as I always say, relax on Sundays. Do nothing, because the best thing about doing nothing is you can quit whenever you want. I will talk to you guys next week, same channel, same time, right here on 1500 Radio, Baltimore's authentic multimedia experience. Have a great week, people. Peace.